Hi, everyone. Welcome to this installment of Speculations the Future Is, part of the school set up by Triple Canopy for Expo One. Today, we're very pleased to have Joseph McElroy speaking with us. Joseph McElroy is the author of a number of novels, starting with A Smuggler's Bible, and including Lookout Cartridge and Ancient History, Heinz Kidnap, Women and Men, which is a good candidate for the Great American Novel, Actress in the House, and coming out next week, we have, why am I blanking on the name suddenly? And we have copies of the bookstore. What's the new book? I'm blanking. What's the title of the new book? Cannonball, of course, yes, which is his new book coming out from Zizank. He's been working for the past few years on an enormous book on water, and he's going to be talking today about water and art, and I'm very excited to see what he'll do. So Joseph McElroy, anyone?
Yes. Now, I wasn't hearing you too well, Dan.
You might need to be a little closer.
Okay, all right. There were many, many topics for this lecture. I think one of them I can come to at the end today. But I was edited by my friend Sam Frank, who felt that we needed something clearer. And what we came up with was something even too clear, or at least not exactly what I imagine that I want to talk about, which I think it was said somewhere that Joseph McElroy would outline a global ethic for or of water. I'll change the word ethic to something vaguer. How about ethos? Because ethos is less punitive and less hortatory, and it's suggesting a consciousness, a whole consciousness, which may include philosophical views or many others, where for me philosophy means much less systems than it means the need of questioning. The need of questioning. And although I want to get right to the burden of today, which is the last part of a book that I've been writing, I don't really mean to sum up the book. I pick from it and indeed try to outline something a little bit in the beginning, like an abstract expressionist account of how the book developed, but not too abstract. But I put it that way because it isn't in the book and because it suggests a denial state that I was in and how I abandoned that. And how the rest of my commentary here will give you some examples from the book, how by unexpected routes I wound up saying what I had intended to say all along. But by then I was a different person, and by then I was seeing things more whole. I'll make that clear in a moment. I thought of speculations, the rather large term under which these lectures are held, and with its notion of seeing, and often of seeing far, or seeing strangely, or seeing in a new way. And I thought of it also because of what I'm going to say, and because of what I believe, and because of two kinds of pragmatism that I better sort of toss out right at the start, that speculations is like basic research. In the last few years, I've worked with a number of environmentalists, and not really worked, you know, not worked as hard as they worked, but worked with them so that I had some sense of their work, and encountered a view of pragmatism which is understandable, but which would embarrass a number of architects I know, because their idea of pragmatism, not really derived from what William James, who popularized the word and his view is a popularization of something else, quite meant. What they meant by pragmatism was what gets built, what gets done. And although I probably won't have a chance to talk about the maker, the progenitor, the group leader of a wonderful and interesting wetland that was created in the Lower Bronx River, and I was involved not with the making of it, but certainly with a lot of instruction as to what it was about, and I eventually wrote about it. But the person who was responsible for it, named Lillian Ball, a really important environmentalist in the East here, but all over, refers rather firmly to pragmatism as a practicality which always means getting the job done. And anything that is associated with, I said basic research, but I'll say also design plans or design imagination, what might not immediately be something you could ask for funding for would not be something that she would regard as pragmatism. And what I'm trying to say, it's kind of an underlying notion. I only realized it now. Pascal says the last thing you decide is what to put first. So I'm putting it first here now, that the pragmatism I have in mind more, not only, but more here, is ideas that, as James put it, have a cash value. And the cash value is here, as you know, not cash, but what would be workable, but more than what would be workable. What would be workable in here? And what would be workable in our relations with a group? Not necessarily what can be made immediately concrete and constructible. And so there is an architectural issue here. And as you will see in an example that I have quite late in these remarks, architects of different kinds, landscape architects and other architects, whom I esteem and have learned from, are very often doing work which is pragmatic and intense, concrete, important, and certainly, because it may not have been worked out yet, except on paper or on the screen, of the future. And so I would, if I have done so, I hope I have done so, set up a difference between two kinds of pragmatism. What William James meant was ideas that can work over the long haul, but that can work for your life. And it extended apparently even into religious notions, where I don't really follow him. I mean, I don't follow him. I understand him. In arguably one of the great works of American literature, The Varieties of Religious Experience. So that's for starters, but there are many starters. There are many starters, and it's perfectly typical of the 7 or 8, maybe it's longer, years that I've been working and not working on water, that yesterday and the day before and the day before, I should receive by email news of negotiations going on between India and Israel about cleaning up their water, and I should receive from somewhere else an email about earthquakes, and I should receive somewhere. In other words, I become not a garbage pail, but I become a repository for all kinds of quick information that people remember Joe might be interested in. And so I've had to have a sense of humor about being at times submerged by what my lapsed Presbyterian self feels that I really ought to be interested in. And what I'm going to try to talk to you about today is one side of what some people might even say is not even part of the environmental movement. But the arts, as they might teach us about water, and not the arts that can be shown to be about water. So there's a river to cross in Faulkner's As I Lay Dying. There's a famous pond in our literature, and there's a famous river, and there are all kinds of works. I'm going to give you some examples of it that use water, but that's not exactly what I'm about. I'm thinking of water, getting ahead of myself necessarily. Thinking of some secondary properties that I've invented, but which are obvious, as a substance that reflects us in all kinds of ways, and so much so that we imagine that it's animate, that it must be thinking about us. And there are times in the course of this when I thought maybe it was thinking about me, and then I figured out a way that maybe I could argue that it was thinking about me, when in fact, like James Joyce, who said that he would look in the corner of a room for a long time until he saw the thing he was looking at looking back at him, which you understand. I don't have to explain that. You know that Joyce was an atheist empiricist, and that he may have meant that psychologically, but he didn't mean anything big by it. So there are problems with water that may suggest that it is more than what it is. In fact, I think water is never only water. And that might be another way of saying what I'm going to try to speak of here. But one can, in the present state of crisis, and even more interestingly, information and activity, because things have changed, you know. An anthology of poems about swimming. There are hundreds of books that I have at home on my shelves about dams that were built and torn down, about pollution, which may make you think not only about let's stop this, but as I have thought, is there something in water that invites pollution? Yeah, well, yes, there is. There is. It's fluidity, it's transparency. So there's such an abundance of information that's coming in, and on top of it, there's the mayor's proposals that appeared in the paper yesterday, and which I examined immediately, worried that there's going to be a big wall, whether or not we can pay for it, that's going to keep the sea out. When one of the themes that I seem to come back to again and again and again in this book of mine that is about revisiting, rethinking, revisiting, that indeed we need not to put up walls against water or treat it as something to be defended against, though obviously we do sometimes. And obviously I don't live in a floodplain in the Mississippi, just as I don't live where there isn't any water to drink. Nonetheless, a theme in the book and in my thinking has been, as far as I can push it, that water needs not to be defended against. And so I was worried about the mayor's proposal, and then I read the rest of it and was interested that wetlands are to be encouraged. And there's a lot there which seems to encourage a reciprocal relationship with water, not just us against water, guarding against. And it's interesting that just as we have had some help from the Dutch here since Sandy, I think it's been since Sandy, so now the Dutch turn out to, for quite a long time, have been thinking that maybe science doesn't have all the answers, and maybe sometimes you have to let the water in if it can soak, if it can. So these issues are difficult. They're not simple. And the information is overwhelming. At the same time that I feel, and it's partly neurosis in me, quite simply, and it has something to do with why I write long books mostly, or even short books that seem long, that I need to listen to all sides. That sounds like I'm a good guy, which I am, but I don't mean it that way. You need to listen to all sides rather than to censor with territoriality, if I can get in the edge here, much less contempt. And this is a time not only of huge amounts of information and of many, many, many wonderful small-scale projects created by environmentalists in this country and all over the place. But it's a time also, as you would imagine, of more than contentiousness. It's a time of competitiveness. And this is, you know, that George Bernard Shaw was probably wrong when he said competition is death, cooperation is life. What we know, I mean, everyone's big idea is a perspective, as Nietzsche pointed out to us. It's a perspective, and it needs to be put out there to compete with other perspectives. That's ideas. That's no censorship. But the censoring with a kind of territoriality of certain projects rather than other projects is something that one could become very sensitive to if one gets involved with some of the environmentalists, which one has to in order to learn, to learn, to learn. And so, if I say water is never only water, I mean it is always a part which is part of something else, and I even find myself arguing myself at one point into the notion that water is quintessentially subordinate. It's an odd thing to say to anybody who's been wiped out by a flood. But by that I mean quintessentially subordinate, that again and again and again we find water as a ground for something else, a condition for something else, as well as a river where something else is happening. And if you want an example from the arts, which I'm now got to get to in a hurry, you have Mehta's film, Water. What an interesting title for a film that's about women, about astonishing things that happen in India. And so there came to be a project and a book. And the book is not quite the same as the project. The project is more what I'm talking about today. And the book is divided into three parts: properties, rights, and imagining. And by imagining, I never, 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 never mean fanciful leisure time. I mean imagining which is connected always to what is possible for human life, what is possible for human association. And with that imagining as a shaping force of a kind, a gathering force, I have thought that we were, I should try myself to build something like an ethos, a consciousness, a way of looking at water. To change the consciousness? Not exactly. But it seemed like that at times to me. What future are we looking at? I mean, here am I talking about the arts, but what future are we looking at? Aquifers that may take 1,000 years to replenish, that are not coming back. What will we do for fresh water? Rising sea levels, are we prepared? Or if we're going to let the water in, do we have surfaces that are porous enough to receive that water? Desal, much too expensive. It's not going to work. The subject is huge. The prospect is dark. And our responsibility for some of it might possibly be reversed, I think. So that's sort of where I am. And instantly, people, individuals, become important. John Cronin, who was the first keeper of the river, keeper for the Hudson River, has all kinds of interesting stories to tell about taking his little boat up the Hudson and finding a huge tank or blowing tubes and picking up water to disappear. But more interesting still, he said when I heard him speak, and it seemed so ungreen, he said, "We're going to be okay, but we need to consult the academies, the universities, and the corporations, because that's where the brains are. And it's through brain power that we're going to get through this." It was odd coming from him, but refreshing too, when I think of the I won't say sanctimoniousness, but the pure of heartness which one gets sometimes from other quarters. And McKibben, a hero. Unquestionably, McKibben. All that he has said to alert us, to warn us, all the work that he has done to show us what is coming, to show us not only the impact of climate change, but the impact of all kinds of waste, very, very important. And what is large about the subject, whereas what I'm approaching with is a smaller angle that I hope can be large. And as I've said, all kinds of small-scale projects all over the world. 200 in the Philadelphia, New York area just last year, like the wetland in the Lower Bronx River that I mentioned. And science seeming to prevail very often, but I've found also science seen as something precise and reliable, when very often, number one, it doesn't have the answers, all of them, and number one, people are speaking really of technology when they say science, and it often leaves people out. And then there is a sacred view that one copes with at the same time as the crisis. And the sacred view speaks of God-given rights, as in India, but also here in the United States, God-given rights to water. And I think of Justice Holmes, who said, rights, you want to talk about rights? The only way you're going to talk about rights and make any sense is you've got to go to court to earn your rights. You don't have a right to water. And when I said something like this to a young man who had taken a bunch of pictures of the Colorado River, and there were wonderful pictures, he was hurt. And he said, what do you mean we need to earn a right to water? It's God-given. It comes down from the heavens. So that's an issue that we have to worry about. But the sacred view has this in common with my own view. It underlines respect and attention, close attention. And I think that that's it's a huge job. My own beginning. It really was my own beginning. Secular patient, a fiction writer, trying to think it through. As I often have undertaken tasks that I wasn't quite sure why. The disasters, the unpredictability, the bad decisions, the bad habits, the bad habits of thought, pessimistic views that are too simple, like it's population, man, let's just stop having children. A lot of truth in that, but it's not the answer. And so, as I began to work on this project, I thought that it was going to be not necessarily what we all agree about. Though understood, when we say not what we all agree about, we may agree that certain things should be done, but we don't do anything about it. So to say that we agree about a lot of things may mean that we're also passive. But it began where has now, by a renewed and different logic entirely, and after trial and error rumination, which I'll sample here a little bit, not doing justice to my prose, but laying bare the potential minorness of my hopes, though not my imagining, I began where I ended, where in fact I have ended. I am ending where in fact I began. And it began as a book about water and aesthetics. Can you imagine in this situation of crisis? With a minor angle, I think that can cast a large shadow, and perhaps a subject that nonetheless drew itself from a bold contrarian view. What was that bold contrarian view? Is it even contrarian? I think so, because the more I thought about emergencies like what you see in Cormac McCarthy's The Road, the more I thought, well, I'm not equal to that. But the more I thought also, in times of emergency where survival is at stake, war, let's say, and there'll be war, there are wars already about water, but I'm talking about an apocalyptic situation like what is in that novel of McCarthy's, all other values go. They disappear. That's obvious. You know, it's platitudinous for me to say that, but it's important to say, because as I approached writing about water, I increasingly thought we are concerned here about the survival, our survival, but the survival of what life? Survival of what life? And in part, water inspiring me to think about this, I thought about another life. Which is, I don't mean a life in the arts, but I mean a real life that we have, which we obviously are trying to protect. And that second life, as the book developed, I found some of the values associated with water enables me to define. So I think I'm even gonna, I've got a little bit of the prose here. Essential, we say water is essential. Essential, we should say, of water, leaving simple what we mean, or somewhat open or really closed, necessary for life, though what life, it may be asked here. For if basic and therefore in some sense undeniably primary, is that survival life our only, or even, dare one say, our best value? When, that is, we see, or it seems to come true at times, that we would not live fully, perhaps not embrace living at all, only as physically surviving, if there were not, we sense, at an early age, getting from day to day, hour to hour, a more, capital M, partly beyond, ahead, around, in this, or us, recalling the history of heroes, Lincoln, Leonardo, Primo Levi, or, and then I think of George Perkins Marsh, the Vermonter who was, did most of his work in Italy as Lincoln's envoy to Italy, but he began in Vermont, who was the first to blow the whistle about deforestation and what happens with water when trees are cut down. So maybe, here I am early, maybe the water so necessary to the life that isn't quite always our best or even main value is itself also not enough. Unless, this is perhaps water too, unless it can continue with us, granting even, I pose experimentally, that this more than physical survival life I'm talking about may retrocausally or non-linearly support that very physical life initial and basic that we've already guessed isn't enough. How might water be organic to what opens all this for us? If it is the condition then inherent in water? Probably not. So it was through a notion of two kinds of survival, precipitated in my mind by the thought of what happens if we run out of water, what happens in an apocalypse, that I moved toward a notion that it's hard to imagine this against the greed and the catastrophic waste of a crisis time, water developing into a commodity, people stealing aquifer water in California and putting it in mile-long plastic containers and towing it over to Greece to sell. When that kind of thing was happening, don't we know water can't belong to us? Think of it in your body. It cannot belong to us. And thinking about its unique invitation to polluters and my doubts about the water managers hired in South America and Europe like independent contractors running prisons. All of this. But perhaps thinking also self-involvedly of when I worked on a Coast Guard weather ship and was out in the Atlantic for 6 months and learned something about weather. Working with various agricultural groups in the West, and then when I was much younger in Pennsylvania. And a child always overlooking New York Harbor, I do not underestimate that as something important, not just as biography, but as something which, like a work of art, perhaps the experience of it may go into the making of you and the making of your thinking. With all this in mind, I came from several directions, and you understand that I'm about to tell you my original project, which I abandoned, embarrassed for its naivete. I came from several directions to think one day that I would write a book about water and the arts. More vulnerable still, about how water, if understood in its strange and surprising appearances in the arts, which are real too, the arts are real too, might change the minds or move the minds, even alter the ethos, hence the ethic, of some of those who are misusing because not seeing both the water, our alternating flood and drought and redistribution responses can't cope with, or water we are just running out of. make even a tiny change in this situation through the arts. There I'm covering myself, a tiny angle on a large subject. Which arts was I thinking of? Which works? A thousand. An example, an early example. Debussy's first arabesque. The way that music, obviously aqueous, among many other things, can work on you. How can it work on you? Neruda's description in a memoir of ice fishing in Russia. The land artist Richard Smithson's spiral jetty in the Great Salt Lake, 15 feet wide, 1,500 feet long, of mud, precipitated salt crystals, rocks, and water. The water slowly receding or rising, in which this spiral was set. For even then, in those naive days of thinking about this project, my standard always was that the work somehow would turn us toward the substance, as if its nature might bear upon the design the artist found, or our thought indeed. Smithson, also with a sense of humor, also witty, elusive like water, which is elusive though water is not witty, I think. We have the sense of humor. Coleridge, Frost at Midnight, where the father in the cabin taking care of the child imagines the frost outside circulating, moving almost like thought, almost like a mind of nature, like rhizomes. A Marcel Pagnol film called Jean de Florette about the virtually murderous greed of villagers who keep from a hapless newcomer the presence of a hidden spring of water on his land. The painter, Pat Steer's Waterfalls, paint exchanging with the weight of water. Ibsen's An Enemy of the People, about a water pollution a town tries to cover up lest it lose the business of visitors to its famous medicinal baths. Emily Dickinson, Everywhere. The Icelandic novelist Halldór Laxness' Independent People. Sheepherders, the wettest novel ever written. Pakistan woman's poem of water experience, having been through floods where people die and don't move away, and the flood comes back. I am a river, she says, flowing into the wrong sea. If only someone could restore me to the desert. Water is never just water. And then also, I thought of another way that water can be seen as an expanse and also as hypnotic not in a good sense. And I thought of it recently looking at the way that crowds of people turn and are envisioned in Gary Winogrand's photographs. Neither out far nor in deep. Is that you? It's me sometimes. The people along the sand all turn and look one way. They turn their back on the land, they look at the sea all day. As long as it takes to pass, a ship keeps raising its hull. The wetter ground, like glass, reflects a standing gull. The land may vary more, but wherever the truth may be, the water comes ashore and the people look at the sea. They cannot look out far, they cannot look in deep. But when was that ever a bar to any watch they keep? That also. And then, just at random, before I get on, drops of water. Drops of water used as a pattern by some young architects, my attention's been called to, devising new building forms. Some of the designs moving towards something almost chaotic. So that was my thought. And very soon I thought, what on earth am I thinking of? That I could hope that art to do with water might persuade the not only unconverted, but worse than that. How could I imagine that it could that it could ever be persuasive in that way? And so what happened was that thinking of water that pours down us like gravity, that absorb proves us porous, that wets our outsides with this capacity of adhering to us, that has a strange surface tension of even fluid water, which is surprisingly strong. I was drawn to biology and chemistry, having abandoned art entirely. And I think I've got to go faster here. And so I thought of the first properties of water that everybody knows about, and went back and studied them. And at every point, I found not only that water is extraordinary that it should be as it is, and thus almost accidentally or on purpose, so necessary for our life. And yet at the same time, mysterious beyond what science can show. And I was thinking, first of all, the astonishing surface tension or cohesiveness, which with the capacity to adhere to surfaces makes capillary action possible, enables trees to imbibe, be nourished and grow and blood circulate. And then the astonishing heat relations of water, which I guess you all know about. I guess everybody knows about, but I bet you don't, or not really. And the more one looks at one of these heat relations, which doesn't explain, but as a result of which, water freezes from the top down rather than from the bottom up. And it does so because at a certain point of descending, it stops descending in temperature and begins to expand. And that is why ice is lighter than water. Thinking of this and thinking of Fargo, North Dakota, thinking of glacial Lake Missoula long, long before we were even thought of, thinking of the effect of ice, the formation of ice, and what it doesn't do, and the reason for this, the heat relations of water, I was drawn further into the subject. And then think also of the universal water as a universal solvent, an inert solvent, that is to say, it doesn't change as it acts as a solvent in whatever it carries or whatever it breaks down. And thinking all the time of poems and stories and paintings and all kinds of things that seem to be associated with the arts, I was much more concerned with trying to figure out how all this happened. And so I went further, thinking that science doesn't really, in the end, tell us very much about why these four characteristics of water exist. You go further and you discover that it's the hydrogen bond. Well, that's interesting, you know, and it's the asymmetrical structure of the water atom, the water molecule, the asymmetrical structure of it, and in collaboration with the hydrogen bond. But that doesn't get us very close either. And so I was moved back to invent my own characteristics of water, secondary and obvious, reflectivity and transparency and fluidity. And then the more I thought about it, a quintessential subordinateness. And that took me with an increasing range of events into drought and flood, and then to the question, the movement of peoples, as I moved from the molecule out to a larger scene. I read Thoreau, who says, apparently of nomads, if a man who has had deep experiences should endeavor to describe them in a book of travels, it would be to use the language of a wandering tribe instead of a universal language. Thus Thoreau, imagining what a translated indigenousness might mean, no true nomad himself, a kind of language, their movements. And as I thought of nomad, and realized that the word has been misused and misused lately and turned into a metaphor, and people who are not nomads at all, not seeking water at all, are nonetheless called nomadic because they move around. I began to think of examples of characters, figures in history, who in their travels were searching for something as if they were nomads, but where water is displaced by that search into something else. And it took me to the history of water. And it took me to the great student of the Southwest, Mary Austin. It took me to Stephen Alfred Forbes, who called one of his original surveys the lake as microcosm, into what now a century and a quarter later we call ecosystems, as he did. He invented the word. And I thought of Henry Adams, a great traveler and also a writer about water. And increasingly, as I got going with this, Adams became one of the personae that I used. Because Adams, in the late 19th century, was confronting a crisis in physics and a whole lot of new information that he did not understand. Seeing it in the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago, stunned by it, he did not know what to do. And he worked with whatever he could understand as well as he could. And that's partly what the education of Henry Adams is about. He was often led to, by his own biases, tremendous anti-Jewish bias, but this is another one, to go too far. But that doesn't bother me, because I see writing as not only writing about what you know, but writing about what you're finding out, writing about what you're learning. And so Adams makes, in his education, a clumsy joke about Ulysses Grant, when he was president, talking to a young woman and saying that Venice would be a great city if it could be drained. And that's supposed to be funny. Obviously, Grant having no sense of Venice as a water city. When in fact, what Grant meant was he meant sewage. Sewage was what he meant. So Adams, as a writer trying to learn how to cope with a crisis with information that is new and strange, became one of the masks that I found myself using. History, after all, we like to think of as heroes, as individuals, but of course it is not. There's all kinds of evidence in the historiography and the theory of history that history has to do with groups, or it has to do with forces. But there were many, many important figures in the history of water. George Perkins Marsh, whom I've mentioned, a great book called Man and Nature, and our own Rachel Carson, known for the book she wrote in the early 60s, Silent Spring, which blew the whistle on pollution. Fascinating writer, and I'm moving back toward what is written here, although still not to the arts. But then a book of hers called The Edge of the Sea, which made a particularly tremendous impression on me. I think the act of writing, the process of the writing here, as with Henry Adams writing about what he's learning as well as what he is an authority on, what he's an authority on is probably a lot of things. He was a great historian of the Jefferson and Madison administrations, but he was an authority on himself. And so he's partly writing about himself. And so when I read Rachel Carson's The Edge of the Sea, I'm aware that more than writing about the fauna and the flora of the beach, she's writing about all that we do not know. She's writing about a process which is like the blurred boundary between sea and land, which in my work moves toward, I'm not going to talk about it here, moves toward a vision of ourselves as amphibious. Amphibious, not only in the old sense, in fact, not in the old sense now, but from that idea, amphibious in a new sense. And as I think of the blurring of the edge of the sea, all that is left when the tide goes back, all that is left to look at, for her book is about looking closely, just as art is. And then what we find when the tide comes back. A very, very beautiful and even disturbing book. I found myself then ready for something that happened. And this is what happened. The result of it is that I went to India in September and October. But what happened was that I came across the work of Anuradha Mathur and Dilip Dakuna, who are Indian landscape designers, who they're based in Bangalore, but they're the stars of the design program at the University of Pennsylvania. And I got interested in their work and corresponded with them, and they invited me down and we talked, and I found out that they were not after me to write something about them. They were interested in me as an amateur. They said that some of their some of their best fragmentary, only in my case fragmentary insights, are from amateurs. And so one thing led to another, and a book of theirs called Soak Mumbai in an Estuary, and partly a visit that they enabled me to take to Mumbai with them to look at some of the projects that are in their book, seemed to be pivotal in the developing project in which I realized I was moving back to something like my original stupid scheme that somehow through the arts we would be able to understand what we needed to understand or even change minds. And their themes are basically to go against what happened in maps in the 17th century, where increasingly the line between sea and land was drawn very, very strictly, as if there was no fluctuation. Their themes have been in response to the 2005 floods in Mumbai to work with water rather than to defend against it, to work with where the land is porous and resilient and may hold the water rather than to devise channels, canals, any course at all by which water, flood water, can be flushed away right away. It's much more than the practical control of water, and indeed a control of water which abdicates control sometimes, which recedes from control. It's much more than that. It comes to sound a little bit like a moral philosophy, and some of the words like resilience seem to have to do with your life, and indeed they do. And so as I went on in my study of them and their response to the monsoon, and their what they mean by aqueous terrain, and as I looked at some of their projects in which a canal dug by the British in the 19th century had caused erosion to a beach, and their plans for an alternative canal which would allow water in. As I studied their what is called wet theory, which does not ask that every city in the world accept water, receive water. Sacramento, it wouldn't work. New York is not going to work either. We don't have enough porosity. But for Mumbai, it would work. And I looked at these 12 projects, and when I went to India, I looked at them closely. And I realized that what we have here, as in fact they say, but not in an arty way, we have science and a kind of art, science and a kind of design collaborating to produce an art that is also never, never separate from the access to activity, the access to adjacent places, the access to each other that is afforded people by their designs. So it's as if somehow protecting against water by not protecting against it, devising some actually built structures, but devising some amendments to beaches and to already existing structures. They were imagining a life in which there was a flow back and forth among people. At this point, I reread an astonishing poem by the American poet A.R. Ammons called Corson's Inlet. It may not be admirable to many people, but it's of great interest. It's abstract, but it's also profound, and it's right in line with Anu and Dilip's notions of how Mumbai might be redesigned. It is about Ammons taking a walk on the beach in the morning, which he did. It's a long poem, and it's about his sense of the beach, partly because of the movement of the water, but for other reasons, being a model of a life lived in which clear, logical, often science-ridden contours and divisions are absent. That there is, excuse the New Age sound of this, a reciprocal exchange, not only of water coming in and going out, but of life there. And so as I went further with the book on Mumbai, which is called Soak, I increasingly felt that the matter of environmental design was coming closer to something that would be called art, but would be called art not in a sense of somebody's poem or somebody's painting, but it would include that. But it would be art which might suggest a living together of people, which means the talking, the communicating, which means all of the things that even a novelist might like to imagine are important, what somebody might want to do. And that's still with me. I mean, that's one of the things you know the mind does. You may reread or not, but you know that when you're reading a book, that there are a lot of parts of the book that are in your mind at the same time. It can be confusing. It's also exciting. It's one of the things that scrolling down or kindling or whatever, I don't kindle, but I know something about reading on the screen, may not quite offer us. I still like the book. But it isn't only the concrete book in my hand, it's the book that's in my mind already, with that scrambling of memory, which is like endless creation of chaotic material, but which is also goes with the energy of constantly recompounding. If you remember Proust, at the beginning of his 3,000-page novel, said that he would sometimes, when he was reading a book, imagine that he was the author. And one thing he meant was that he was. He was. Just as you are when you read a book that you love, and especially when you reread. And so, crudely, briefly, the aesthetic in relation to a design for living seemed to come at me in a somewhat different and fuller way and more confusing with the work of these Indians. And long before this, and we were talking about this at 2 o'clock, I'd become interested in the work of a garlic farmer in New Mexico named Stanley Crawford, who was also an excellent writer, and who wrote a book called Mayor Domo, which, since many of you were in the room 2 o'clock or 2:30 or whenever, when we were talking about it, I won't go into in great detail. But suffice it to say that in addition to being a garlic farmer, a real farmer, he's a real writer. And among many books, this one won a prize, thank God for him that he won a prize. Prizes are good. It doesn't matter what people say. Prizes are good, and they bring money. It's a book called Mayor Domo, which refers to the manager of the irrigation ditch. Major Domo, huh? Mayor Domo. The lord of the place, is that what it means? Perhaps, the lord of the place. This is the first Anglo manager in a Hispanic ditch in northern New Mexico, a job he took on. The book tells about how. What is more important to me here is how, as the days go on, the book is about 1 year in that job, but there are many years ultimately. As the book goes on, we learn about the actual work that's being done. But we learn also about the essential relation of not only the ditch manager to other people, but other people to each other, to everybody. And how, in a certain sense, it's a communal endeavor. And certainly not a utopian one, because people hated the work. It was difficult. It was boring. People sloughed off. There were all kinds of problems that the manager had. Real life. And as the book goes on, because Crawford can also write like Thoreau, there are beautiful passages, but not many. Tolstoy says somewhere that when he comes across something that he wrote at 2 o'clock in the morning, and he really thinks it's beautiful, he knows he's going to cut it out the next day. I think Crawford is not a masochist quite like that. But some of it is beautiful, but mostly it is not beautiful in that sense. However, there comes a time when he looks at the acequia, which is the irrigation ditch, and also it means also the community of people who share in the irrigation ditch. There comes a time when he looks at the acequia in the morning and thinks that it is beautiful. And he's just looking at an irrigation ditch, you know, with beaver dam. It's a mess. It's work. But it's beautiful. And he realizes that there's something more than landscape here, something more than landscape. And here is where that book of many makes a kind of bond with the book about Mumbai. Much later in the book, he suddenly almost surprises one by saying that with all the talk about water, all the necessity of water in a dry country, northern New Mexico, the need of water in these market gardens that are not doing very well, and there's terrible drought out there right now. This is some years ago. What was more important than the water? In fact, it had a kind of, I mean, I know how careful he was before he wrote these words down. There's a kind of aesthetic quality that the work with other people had in this setting, but also in itself. So the acequia is beautiful, and the reason that he has makes a curious judgment of the aesthetic nature of the work is the people. This at a time when the acequia tradition is probably dying. And we learn later that he's had to use drip irrigation and other devices in order to survive. But that's not the main issue. It's that there is here an aesthetic dimension that in an area and in a work that you might not normally expect. And so the more I thought of this and went back to Richard Smithson, Spiral Jetty, which is art, you know, it's a work of art. It's not intended to make anybody think about salt water. I nonetheless asked myself, what happens in oneself when a work of art affects one? There was an unexpected place that the writer endows with the idea of aesthetic or art. But now I was thinking again of those examples of art that I thought, oh God, I could never persuade some bloody capitalist to think better of water through teaching him about, you know, it was embarrassing. I embarrassed myself. Have you ever embarrassed yourself? Well, it can be instructive. It teaches you to forgive yourself. And in this case, I found that I was coming back to the same place where I was, except from a different route, from a notion of group aesthetic or group art, because that's not the only way to go, obviously. There are still the individuals. And if we remember that art, if it works, is almost always particular, but it is almost always in some weird way reaching out beyond. I see here poets and painters and architects, and you don't have to be an artist to know what I've just said. And I thought of Andy Goldsworthy, not my favorite of the installation environmental artists, but very interesting when you think that the only record we have of that, what he does, of the most interesting things he does with water is videotape. You know, I mean, the whole idea is that the ice is melting and then it's done, you know. And yet it's beautiful with the river and with the wood and so forth. And then I thought of Rachel White Reed, an English artist who turned outside into inside, or really inside into outside. And for years there was on LaGuardia Place a water tower, which was luminous because it was made out of resin, a huge water tower size water tower made out of resin. A work of art, wasn't containing water, but it made one think. It made one think also of water towers, of which there are many, many, many in New York. Indeed, I remember that on the cover of a reprint of my novel Women and Men. We got a photograph of a bunch of water towers at dusk, as I remember. It's very, very beautiful, so that the water tower becomes an object of beauty. We could analyze that, but we don't have time to. And the more I thought about the aesthetic element of work that I would not normally have thought art, with environmental rehabilitation in mind, habitat renewal, of which I knew quite a lot here, people often calling it art, the more I realized that we were in some kind of small scale issue of, is this new work art? And at a conference of geographers, I heard a UK professor who'd done interesting work in Hong Kong, in Kowloon, which I gather was a watercourse reconstruction project which would move water where it was giving them trouble to an area where it was not giving them trouble. And I heard him argue for dispensing with, quote unquote, problem-based, fetishistic modernism, yes, in favor of a collaborative ecopoiesis, making new narratives of new processes of dwelling. In effect, art as the making of a life support system. What I rejected about that was not his notion that art might be communal in the way that he was saying, much less that it might be environmentally communal. What I rejected was the censorship of it, the saying that individual art was done, we're finished with that. What I came to, yes, I gotta stop. What I came to was a question again of not how can I preach to someone else to change their mind. I came to a question of what happens inside us, to the individual, to myself, when I experience a work of art. I reached in many directions. Richard Serra, over big, undoubtedly, over powerful, leaning on us unquestionably, but a great, great sculptor, made a distinction between his work and that of his friend Frank Gehry, an architect. What Gehry does is not art, what I do is art. He said, however, also in the same interview, he said, what I do is I change the consciousness of space that people have when they are in one of my works. That was interesting to me. And I wondered if I was becoming utilitarian, or if something was dementing my mind. But I thought, well, if something's happening inside me when I'm in the middle of a Serra structure, you've seen some of the big torque ones, and they look like vessels, don't they? And maybe you think, well, the guy grew up in a shipyard almost, and you think that way, but you're not supposed to think that way, but you know that it changes you. If it changes you, then maybe it changes you in mysterious ways that have an impact upon the way you act. And that took me back to Spinoza, who says, art adds to me, which in the last part of my book, which is not here today, I don't speak of it here today, the third part called Imagining, I try to use as a way of making a connection of consciousness between the experience of art and the ethical life. The ethical life. Without ever saying, reading novels make you better. You know that's not true. Or maybe it is. Spinoza, art adds to me. And as I went back over, I'm stopping now, rereading, like revisiting a river, which is always the same. Rereading Ulysses, section 17, which is the catechism section in which Leopold Bloom is entertaining Stephen late at night, and they're having an amazingly good time. Leopold goes to the stove to make some tea. And there is this astonishing passage. I have here to read it to you, but I'm not going to. You go read it. about the municipal water system in Dublin and about all the things that water does. A fantastic compendium of water. Information, you could say. Information. Oh, well, Joyce is telling you all about water. But you know, it isn't only that. It's in the context of an astonishing novel, and it happens to be in a section 17 in which, as many of us know, he is imitating the catechism. What is true of the catechism? You give the same answer to the same question over and over again. That's the catechism. That proves your faith. It's a ceremony. I don't knock it. I probably do it to myself in other ways. But here is the catechism in which Leopold Bloom asks a question about water, and another answer comes out that you never expected. And so that's where I am. And three. An architect friend of mine who's here showed me the other night some work by his students at Pratt. He also teaches at Columbia, which is generated by a moving photograph of water. And their assignment was to make buildable structures inspired by water. Seems to me it's a communal event, it's also an individual event. Seems to me it's also a building coming out of water. And another important thing came up when I said, well, some of this is really like my own novels, at the risk of being disordered, or at the risk at next door to near going toward chaos. He said, I want them to go right into chaos. So there's an example of the aesthetic in action and arising from water. Another, the second, I had an email from her 2 days ago. I taught a course at Temple University called The Meaning of Water. The Meaning of Water. It's a big title, like a novel of mine, Women and Men. And the students were required to do 2-term papers. One was an environmental essay, you know, something about pollution or the water supply or something like that. Could be scientific. And the other was creative if they wanted. And this young woman did her father had access to then unclassified documents that had to do with a certain event that was happening in the Defense Department. And she based her work, it was visual, on that, on her access to this information, which was a triptych about waterboarding. A triptych about waterboarding. It blew me away. Make of it what you can. And always, if we're thinking of the large scope of water, the large scope of what needs to be done, the huge amounts of money, $20 billion, all of the big, big, big scale, as we likewise think of the small scale jobs that are invented by people near us and so forth, there is also a small poem by a poet who understood solitude, and a poem that I understand but don't understand, which I could recite, but I'm going to read it, by Emily Dickinson. And it seems to me it reminds us that water is never just water. Water is never just water. And you will see what it is also. In fact, by the time we get to the end of the poem, maybe it isn't about water anymore. Water, this is number 1428. Imagine that. There are 1700. Water makes many beds for those averse to sleep. Its awful chamber open stands. Its curtains blandly sweep. Abhorrent is the rest in undulating rooms, whose amplitude no end invades, whose axis never comes. Is it about insomnia? Is it about water? I think about many things, but if nothing else, it might suggest how far inward, indeed, and how far outward a water inspiration might go in helping to shape a consciousness. And I have gone on too long, but I'm going to stop now. But believe it or not, I'd like some questions. Thank you.